Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com and the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 133, The Sherlock Holmes Collection of Dan Poznanski.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
And welcome once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Burt Wolder.
And we have collected you here today in the Collector's Corner to talk about probably one of the most remarkable collections in the world. We'll get to that in just a moment. What's up, Burt?
Well, I'm just sitting here with my dust jackets being clipped and my pages foxing and becoming more valuable by the minute, I guess. You know, when you speak to me, you're not speaking to any Burt Wolder. You're speaking to a rare first edition Burt Wolder.
Well, thank goodness. Except no substitutes. I'm glad it's not the pirated edition of Burt Wolder.
No, and it's not the paper edition. He was here a while ago, but crumbled to dust.
Oh boy, always keep your eye out for that guy. Well, you know, if folks would like to get in touch with us and tell us how much they love or hate the show, we're happy to hear from you. Either way, you can reach us at ihearofsherlock.com on the web, and the show notes for this particular show are ihose.co/ihose133. You of course can reach us by email at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. You can reach us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, all as I Hear of Sherlock. You could even pick up the phone from time to time and give us a call. Why don't you call us anymore? Don't you love us? 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323.
Well, you know, folks, basically we are lonely. We need people to call us. I mean, we like talking to each other, obviously, but we're happier talking to you. So let us know what you like. Compose a long list of things that you think define the show's excellence. Type it up several times. Send us a carbon copy. Make a PDF of it and email it to us. And also write one or two small polite suggestions in three or four words, not really more, and send that along too, and we will do our best to study it as soon as our monocles are polished.
Well, if you haven't joined us recently over on Trifles, that's our other podcast that comes out on a weekly basis, go ahead and do that. We have a number of episodes out recently talking about morality in the military, in the Sherlockian canon. We talk about the supernatural just after Halloween.
We talk about monocles. We talk about Paul Snell.
It's all good
stuff. We talk about handsome cabs and even ugly cabs. So that's the place to go.
Whatever happened to the ugly cabs?
Well, I didn't take the first one. I didn't take the second one. I took the third one, but I don't remember where I left it.
Oh, so it was natural selection.
Well, speaking of natural selection, that's how one assembles a noted collection.
Mm-hmm.
Friends, the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex is working to secure our border with Mercia. We're building a wall. Unfortunately, people in Chippenham grouse about needing a passport to go to Gloucester. They are small-minded, but thankfully, you have wide interests. You're curious about the architecture of Yoxley Old Place. You have questions about the problem of Thor Bridge. You wonder about Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper. That's why you cherish your copy of Unmitigated Bleat, selected writings by Paul D. Herbert, and marvel that its 221 pages are a mere $19.95. Friends, winter is coming, when around, above, a world of snow, the light-heeled breezes breathe and blow. The perfect time to reach for the pleasure only a volume from the Wessex Press can provide. Choose yours today.
And always delightful to hear about how you can continue to add to your collection of Wessex Press books there. Love those guys. Glenn Moranker last joined us on episode 79 to discuss his own remarkable Sherlock Holmes collection. And interestingly, two episodes before that, Dan Poznanski joined us in episode 77 to talk about, well, his life as a Sherlockian as well as the Speckled Band of Boston. Now, Dan and Glenn have been friends for over 40 years. And of course, as you know, both are members of the Baker Street Irregulars. But it's Dan we're here to talk about, because Dan's dogged pursuit of the most arcane and rare of Sherlockiana and Doyleana over the course of really 60 years has resulted in a legendary collection. And that collection is now up for auction on December 19th in Calabasas, California, by Profiles in History. And it's also happening online and by proxy. So if you can't make it out to California on December 19th, fear not. The catalog alone is worth collecting. And Glenn is the guy who helped put it together with a team of other folks. And there is perhaps one collection, one Sherlockian collection per generation that becomes available in this fashion. And Dan's is the collection for our time. And we can't possibly do justice to the breadth and depth and variety of items in the collection. But Glenn can give us a sense as to what we're looking at and historically why it's important and why Sherlockians need to pay attention to this very unique collection. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, it's Glenn Moranker. Hey, Glenn.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Did we describe Dan's collection effectively enough in that introduction?
Well, I certainly think so. I mean, Dan's collection was collections of anywhere near that stature are, of course, unique. One is not like the other. They have plenty of unique items. But Dan's was particularly so. You know, the kinds of books, the information and pamphlets and postcards and letters that Dan was able to locate and the information he found out about it and the backstories and the atmospherics of the things in his collection gave it an absolutely unique and unrivaled heartbeat.
It's not just the uniqueness of some of those events. It's the sheer volume of them, isn't it?
Well, in some cases, it's the volume. For example, nobody has anywhere near the collection of pirated editions that Dan had.
For those who aren't familiar, can you tell us what pirated editions are?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. In the mid to late 19th century, up until roughly speaking, World War One in the 20th century, there were these fellows who would publish books without first obtaining copyright, without obtaining permission of the author or the, whoever the heck the copyright owner was. And the most favored folk for the United States pirateers to steal were, of course, the British authors. Not only were they very well known and very popular, but they, because they were outside of the United States, they, in effect, didn't have any effective legal recourse. And also, there was no translation problem. I mean, you know, stealing the French would have been a big problem. You'd have to first get the books translated before you could publish them. So the British authors, you know, Doyle, Jerome K. Jerome, Dickens, were very widely, the material was very widely stolen by this group of publishers. And there, the import, the magnitude of that business is not to be overlooked. In fact, in 1898, 1899, I have forgotten, the authority on American paper publications, Tebel, tells us that something like half of the published books in the United States were published by pirate publishers. So they were enormous. And, of course, this was not their motivation, but they actually did a service. And the service was that they made books very inexpensive. Books that they published could be as inexpensive as a nickel. More typically, they were a dime or 15 cents a copy. But this compares to several dollars for a book, which, to put it, you know, to put it in some kind of relevant measure, you know, was a month's worth of bread. So, you know, except for newspapers and the Bible, common man didn't have books. They were just not affordable until the pirateers came along. So there, by, I don't know, coincidence is not quite the right word, but by coincidence, though, an interesting number of the pirate publications, besides having many of them have colorful publication histories, are bibliographically important. For example, the first separate publication, as opposed to a story in a magazine, of Case of Identity or the Redheaded League, are in fact American pirate publications. The first American book edition of The Sign of Four is a pirate publication and predates the authorized book publication in the United States by two or three years. So some of them have important bibliographic significance.
And of course, there's an edition of The Sign of Four that Conan Doyle signed for, it looks like, Eugene Field. And there's a wonderful doodle on the frontispiece.
Yeah, that's a staggering book. Conan Doyle made a lecture tour of the United States in late 1894. And he spent a fair amount of time in the Midwest, Indianapolis, Chicago. And during that particular leg, he signed a number of books for a number of folks. And in most cases, I believe innocently, these folks that bought pirated copies, Doyle very graciously just signed them. In the case of
Eugene Field,
Field had been on a campaign. You know, Eugene Field is still remembered by some folks. He wrote a lot of children's stuff, and he wrote the poem Winkin' Blinkin' and Nod.
Oh.
So he's not a completely forgotten 19th century author. But the Fielding had written an interesting number of what today we would call op-ed pieces railing against the pirate publishers. And so, of course, we don't know, but we know Fielding met Doyle while he was in the Chicago area, and while we can't know what their conversation was, presumably they specifically talked about pirateers, and Fielding specifically presented him with this pirated copy. And Doyle wrote a little piece of doggerel and, you know, and with a little sketch and said, he, you know, he hoped the pirates would pull a swing from their own yardarms.
Well, but, how many pirated editions are in Dan's collection?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, a wild guess, I would say in a hard copy, he must have 7,000 or 8,000. And in paper, I've not counted them, but the paper pirates that he accumulated are now part of the Marenker collection.
Why? So, Glenn, can you give us an outline of what is coming to auction? You know, roughly how many pieces, what the categories are, because the catalog, as Scott mentioned, is really quite wonderful, and it begins with historical information, family information, notes from Conan Doyle's uncle and other relatives. And so you also get in this collection historical information from people like Dickie Doyle, the great illustrator, and so on. So can you just give us sort of a high level of the scope of it? You already talked about the pirated editions. There are some letters. What else? What else? What are the highlights when you look at what's coming to auction?
Well, let me kind of answer your question, then I'll answer your question. The kind of part is the parts that are coming up for auction that I'm most excited about. You know, there's a good deal of correspondence with, for example, Walter Pond, who set up his American tours. And I think correspondence, as well as some letters back to his friends and various clubs in London, describing his experiences in America. And I just find those endlessly fascinating and quite a glimpse into Conan Doyle and his attitudes about writing, about America, about the relationship between America and Great Britain. So those are, I'm particularly fond of those. The other thing is there are a lot of personal Doyle items, things discussing his uncles. He comes from a large group of artists of either very good and up talent, including his father. If his father wasn't so ill for, you know, the bulk of his adult life, he very likely would have been much more successful as an artist. But certainly Dickie Doyle is, you know, on the short list of great Victorian illustrators. So, and, you know, we shouldn't overlook James Doyle, yet another accomplished illustrator. And, you know, there's some discussions there between Jean and Jane. There's some letters from Dickie Doyle, his mother, Mary Conan Doyle, not an illustrator, but nevertheless extremely influential in his life. Every reference I have seen by Conan Doyle to his mother always refers to her as the ma'am, not as mom or mother. So there's some story there which I don't happen to know. I don't know if it's been explored or not, but I don't know it. There are certainly some letters from our good friend Adrian. So the personal, the private letters are extensive. They're interesting. They're not bread and butter letters. You know, they deal with publication, family matters, and so forth. If my memory serves me correctly, there's one where Conan Doyle's talking to Bram Stoker about moving forward with a dramatic project, with a play.
Yeah, in general, at a high level here, you know, this is almost 300 items with an enormous trove.
Yeah, the number of lots is about 300. That's right. Some of the lots have many items.
Many items. So it's clearly, you know, well over 1,000 different items in 300 lots, roughly. And as you point out, it has a lot of information about aspects of Conan Doyle's life that we know little or nothing about, his correspondence with Walter Pond, but also some insight into his family dynamics. And it's very broad. It includes, among other things, a doll given to William Gillette. It includes a gasogene. If one would like a gasogene, you have an opportunity to buy one from the Poznanski collection, and many other things. How do you feel when you step back and look at the catalog and look at all these items? What does it tell you about Dan the collector? How is Poznanski's focus as a collector sort of different from other people's?
Well, it's certainly the case that he was dogged in his pursuit of one of a kind items. There's very, very little boring things in his collection. You know, as an example, and I mean this in the positive sense, the representation of the first, you know, the first editions is quite minimal. Now, two first printings unequaled, you know, something like Beaton's, or the first printing of separate printing of as opposed to magazine appearance of The Sign of Four. He has those, but the first American edition of The Sign, well, yes, he has a couple of copies, but not the definitive representation of the American authorized first edition. So the for him, things that could be monumental to most collectors, normal collectors, were not what drew most of his energy and his attention. Things like source materials shedding light on his dealings in the U.S., source materials with his colleagues or contemporaries in publishing, like Barry, like Bram Stoker, like Oscar Wilde. He has materials like that.
So part of the building of Dan's collection, the process by which he accumulated all of these. And by the way, I should say, I really didn't understand the breadth and sheer volume of his collection until one day in Boston, he said to me, I asked him about a particular volume. He said, "Oh, I'll get that the next time I visit my warehouse." And warehouse. And lo and behold, he had his collection or parts of his collection in a warehouse, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Until fairly recent years, he had he owned a building, and it was a warehouse, and a floor of it was filled with his collection, or filled with, shall we say, the overflow of his collection. You know, it's like the proverbial basement in the British Museum.
Yeah.
You know, where it seems once or twice a year, some heretofore unknown discovery is made. And the same could be said for Dan's materials. I mean, let me give you an example, and this is also an example of what I call the Poznanski effect. Do I need to describe the Poznanski effect?
Please, I was going to ask you about that. This is great.
Dan and I would get together with great regularity. He would show me something that I had not seen. Maybe often I didn't even know about. Sometimes I knew about it, but I'd never seen a copy. And with great frequency, not 100% of the time, but with great frequency, once he showed it to me, I would turn up a copy. 2 months later, 6 months later, a year and a half later. But nevertheless, this happened far too often for it to be a coincidence. I think he had magic powers. And I was just thinking in terms of an unusual item that Dan had shown me, actually maybe as long ago as 2 years ago, was this a British publication called The Family Doctor. It was a pretty long lived. I mean, I've now seen numbers as large as 400 and 500. And it, you know, it was a, I've seen only a couple of copies, but it seems like it was, a little bit more formal than folksy advice for average folks about health. One article I specifically remember was warning against the unhealthiness of long dresses, that bacteria could accumulate if there was insufficient air circulation between the legs.
Yeah, I've been warning Bert about those for years.
Yeah, and so that's one of the reasons I guess kilts are above the knees. But in any event, Dan, show me a version of this magazine from November 1893, I think it was. And on the back of the magazine, the back page of this particular issue, there's a pastiche, Sherlock Holmes and the Missing Box.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, November 1893, I have not done. Oh, and lo and behold, I found one of these in a hole-in-the-wall bookstore in nowhere, Great Britain, about an hour north of by train north of London. I haven't had the time to research it, but it wouldn't surprise me if this is not that this it has to be one of the first pastiches ever written.
Yeah,
I mean, this is you know, 2 years after the end of The Adventures and Memoirs in the Strand.
Now, how did you find yourself in such a location to be able to come upon this publication?
Well, first of all, just about wherever I am, I investigate to see if there are any opportunities to find interesting books, which is, and I mean that more broadly. It's not just Sherlock Holmes. I like interesting books. And this particular spot was not too far from Bletchley Park. Certainly you and Bert know about my interest in World War II crypto.
Yes.
And so it's been a little while, so maybe 2 years, but there was a very long period of time where I made regular pilgrimages to Bletchley Park to look at the stuff, meet some of the people, on occasion to use the archive there. And, of course, while I was in the area, I visited bookstores that were within easy drive of where I was staying.
So as any right thinking person would do.
Listen, there are, let's just say I'm very serious about collecting.
Yeah.
And I think there needs to be a better word for it, because it's not a burden. It's a delight. And to find things that are interesting needs some, serious application. And it's fun. It's delightful. It's educational. It's rewarding. Fortunately, even when you don't find things, because most of the time you don't find things. I'm not being secretive. I honestly don't remember the name of the town that I was in. The town I was staying in was after the guy who came to wants to know. Bletchley Park is right next to a 1960s Greenbelt experiment. And it's, this awful, laid out roads and, green manicured lawns and 1960s looking houses. It's really terrible. But 10 minutes away is a little town called Aspley Guys, which looks right out of Midsummer Murders. Just, picture perfect and, hedgerows between them. And that's where I stay.
Glenn, in the introduction that you wrote for the catalog, you talked about Dan's ability to spot things of collecting value. It was an uncanny ability. And you also shared kind of the full variety of places the two of you used to go, and where Dan's favorite haunts sometimes were, where one wouldn't think you'd find rare books or rare items. You want to tell us about that a little bit?
Well, I will share a couple of the master's secrets. But first of all, I'm certain I don't know all of them, but I'll share a couple of them. One of my personal favorites is used furniture stores. Certainly not every single one, but used furniture stores when they would buy a bookcase or a china case with a couple of extra shelves in it. When they picked it up, it also often had books left over in it. And they really, for the most part, didn't know what the heck to do with them. So, you know, dropping into likely looking, and you smell it, you feel it. Under threat of death, I couldn't tell you what the secret is, but you feel when a furniture store seems like it might have a stash of books. One of the earliest that Dan showed me was sort of on the backside of Cambridge, and I just don't remember the name anymore. This would have been 1977 or 78. They would accumulate the books for a year. And a couple of weeks before Christmas, they would open up at like 6 a.m. and first come, first serve, people would buy the books. The number of interesting pirates that turned up at that shop was amazing. Just amazing.
Would Dan just pull up with a truck?
Well, Dan always had these big cars, you know, like LTDs and stuff, and the rear seat was really for storage, not for passengers. And again, you know, he was, well, it's hard when you're pressed for time, to be selective with pirated editions. And the reason for that is, two books that, certainly from the outside look alike, from the title page and table of contents, even they look alike. The back matter may be different. These guys were published in relatively short runs, and in the back, in the end matters of these books, they would have advertisements. Sometimes they'd stick in another short story. I guess they felt the book had to have a certain heft in order to be saleable. They just stick in the story. It wouldn't be mentioned on the cover. It wouldn't be mentioned in the table of contents. You leaf through one of these, you know, these books that appears to be a copy of Study in Scarlet, and in the back is a J.M. Barrie short story or something. So these superficially identical books may be different. Often you just don't have the time on the spot, so you just vacuum them up. You know, another example is a good example is in bookstores is the humor section. They're often unlikely books. They're books in the humor section, which will have, pastiches or they're so broad. They're probably more, you know, better called burlesques that involve Sherlock Holmes. That's certainly something, Dan clued me into. My favorite book that panned out, that way is I was in a shop in San Francisco. And there was this book in the humor section called "A Saw Screams at Midnight," and it called out to me, and I pulled it off the shelf, and I started to look through it, and I was all set to get it. It's not an old book. It's an early 50s book. Although not credited, all the illustrations show Carl Reiner. So, you know, it's clearly a book by Carl Reiner. And it's, you know, all about how, you know, the era of the new suburbia. And it's all about, you know, house maintenance and so on and so forth. And I was all set to get it because I'm a woodworker and I'm leafing through it. And all of a sudden, about midway through the book, the title story, A Saw Screams at Midnight, is The Adventure of the Purloined Pants with Sherlock Holmes. So here's a, you know, unprepossessing book in the humor section, and it has a Sherlock Holmes story in it. Now, I have got another story about that. I boxed it up with return postage on it, and I mailed it to Carl Reiner, Hollywood, California, and asked him to inscribe it for me. And about a month later, it came back inscribed.
That's wonderful.
I mean, I had no idea what his address was, but apparently the Hollywood post office knew how to get it to him.
Yeah. That's like Santa Claus at the North Pole, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Another, you know, very early on, I mentioned in the write-up in the Profiles in History auction that Dan's second visit to my place in Cambridge, you know, he showed up with boxes and boxes and boxes of books, which he gave me, Sherlockian books. And he spent a great deal of time explaining to me what was important and what wasn't important, what made things important, and so forth. And over the years, we've had many such discussions, but that was the most extensive of the very early ones. At any rate, he mentioned to me that one book which I must have was Bell's Chronology of the Adventures.
Mm.
2 or 3 weeks later, was entertaining my in-laws and who were visiting, and I took them on my circuit of used bookstores. We were in Ernie Gloss's bookshop, Brattle Books, was not finding anything. And Janet, my mother-in-law, comes over and says, you know, I saw this book on the owner's desk. If you had been to a Brattle in the early days, Ernie had this desk kind of near the door with a cash register and piles of books, which he was pricing. And she says, it said, you know, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson on it. So I go over to his desk, and there is the Bell Chronology. I pull it out of the pile, and I said, you know, I'd very much like this book. I see it's not priced yet. Would you please price it for me? But it's useful to remember this is 1976 or 77 or 78. I'm in grad school and so on and so forth. So I'm all scrunched up, and I say, you know, I could pay 20, maybe I'd even pay $25 for this book. And he looks at me, and he looks at the book, and he looks at me, and picks up a red pen, and he writes the price on the front free end paper, $2.98.
Oh my gosh. And here in the catalog, we have a copy of H.W. Bell's Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, The Chronology of Their Adventures, 1932, yes. Right? Limited, yes, to 500 copies. And this,
yes,
in this case, this is an association copy.
The copy in the catalog is the salmon color, the red colored copy. That is incredibly scarce. There are a letter which I believe is in the Houghton collection. I don't think it's one of Dan's letters, but it's in the Houghton collection, where Bell is writing to a friend. I can't recall who now.
Ethel.
And he's, sorry?
Ethel.
Ethel.
Dear Ethel.
It's Ethel. Yes. And he's writing very enthusiastically that his book is about to be published. He's seen some of the proofs, and he's going to have 10 or 12 of them specially bound, and his words are in Chinese red for him to give to his friends. So it's the only concrete evidence we have as to the size of the run of books that are in the red binding. The regular binding, of course, is Kelly Green.
It's green, yeah.
And so the belief is that there are or were 10 of these. And certainly the three or four that I have seen have all had large, you know, lengthy inscriptions to clearly close associates of Bell.
And
so this is not just a chronology.
Right.
This is one of the 10 China Red books.
That's right. And that's one of three copies of Bell's Chronology that Dan has. There is another one, a green one, that actually comes with a dust jacket. And you very, very rarely see these volumes with the dust jacket. So that's impressive.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, who knows why dust jackets survive and why they don't survive, but you're absolutely right. Dust jacket is very striking. It's silver. I mean, it is almost metallic silver.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't see it very often.
And then there's another copy same book, H.W. Bell's chronology, that belonged to Vincent Sterrett. And it reads, "Dear Johnson, I deplore Mr. Bell's book because he's laid far too great an emphasis on Watson's meretricious stories. Nevertheless, I send you this in memory of our work together during the years. Yours sincerely, S. Holmes."
As I said, Dan does not have ordinary things. A Bell chronology, which is extremely well done, is the first very carefully done, scholarly done list of the stories in the order in which they occurred, as opposed to their publication order, is certainly a cornerstone of any Sherlockian collection. It's pretty tough. It's hard to find. And you look in the Poznanski collection, he has, you know, one of the 10 special that were specially done up for the friends of Bell. And the quote, ordinary green copy he has, was inscribed to Vincent Sterrett. And that is Dan Poznanski's collection. And it's just item, it's just one item after the other. As I said, it's the overall atmospherics. There are those of us who are fortunate enough in many senses of that word to have some extraordinary items in our collection, a signed book, an association copy, a copy in a jacket, and so on and so forth. But close to all of Dan's stuff is like that. Something extraordinary. Either the particular copy is extraordinary, or the book itself is just remarkably rare, and so having any copy is astounding. I dare you to go find a handy classic series of any title, let alone the Holmes titles. I think I'm a pretty good book hunter, and it took me decades to find a couple of those. So, and, you know, Dan has the definitive representative set of them. So his energy, his stick-to-itiveness, his knowledge, his imagination, nobody is better. There may be some folks who were as good in one or two of those aspects, but there was nobody better in any of those aspects than he is. So I have to say it's extremely bittersweet for me to see these books coming up for auction. Certainly he's doing the collecting world a favor, you know, keeping these books in circulation, keeping these items in circulation, letters, books, pamphlets, dolls, quite a thing. It's just amazement to me that he is parting with them while he's still breathing.
There are some extraordinary items here, and obviously most of the things here are not for the novice collector, not for someone just starting out their collection, although there are a few items of ephemera that may be affordable to folks starting out. But I have to imagine, you know, when there is a $10,000 to $15,000 doll, for example, or a $25,000 book from the 1940 BSI dinner. There's a very limited audience for that. What happens to the stuff, to the lots that go unsold? Where do they go?
Oh, you know, I honestly have no idea. But they will be in good homes. They'll be in they will be in, with a little luck, they'll be in places where they are reasonably accessible. I mean, they may not be geographically in the most convenient place, but.
So, Glenn, you mentioned earlier, you know, Dan's warehouse. So when you were assisting in compiling this catalog and inventorying all these items and getting things organized, were there a couple of surprises for you and things that you found that you hadn't seen before?
Oh, many. Certainly, the wealth of letters was something which surprised me. I'd seen a great number of them, but there are a million of them. That was probably the biggest surprise. There were some individual books that were a surprise. there were variants on books where I didn't know Dan had as many variants as in fact he did have. And for the really serious collector, those can be important. And one of the reasons they can be important is often the precedence of the variants is not known. And so if you're bound and determined to have the first edition, you either do the definitive research and figure out which and manage to figure out which what the precedence is, or you get them all.
One of the nice things about Dan over the years is that he, like many collectors, not like all collectors, but like many collectors, has always been very eager to share his enthusiasm, share some of these unique items, share elements of his collection with other people. And I know that towards the end of the year, close to Christmas, there's a small group, the Friends of Irene Adler, that meet in Boston. And I recall over the years Dan coming to those dinners with his copy of Beaton's Christmas Annual, with the original letters that Franklin Roosevelt wrote back to the Baker Street Irregulars. And things like that, and he would talk for several minutes about what you described earlier: the context, the historical value, additional information about some of these particular things. That's been a wonderful part of his collecting experience.
Now, Dan is generous to a fault with his time and his knowledge. I was just just great good luck that the first collector that I ever met brought that perspective to the activity. I both benefited in a direct sense the times he visited and talked to me and brought me boxes of books, and in the indirect sense he set a great example which I absolutely follow. I don't understand collectors who aren't. A large part of for me and Dan and the joy of collecting is the sharing, and that goes both ways. You share with another collector. There are other collectors. If they don't happen to have spectacular items, they almost invariably have wonderful experiences and stories to share. So I think you diminish the activity by not being generous. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me.
You know, we usually start our interviews by asking our guests about their first meeting with Sherlock Holmes, and we've already gone through that exercise with you. Well, why don't you tell us about your first meeting with Dan Poznanski?
Oh, sure. Well, my first meeting with Dan Poznanski was 1976, sometime in the fall. I was in graduate school at MIT, and one Saturday I'm home, working away on my thesis, probably in a foul mood. And Kathy, my wife, went out for a walk. She comes back from this walk and says, "I brought you a present to cheer you up." And she hands me this book, and it was an American first edition of the Casebook of Sherlock Holmes. And I had no collection. I had, the Doubleday Fleet Stories, and I don't know that I had any other Sherlock Holmes book. I look at the book, and I said, "Oh, my God, you mean you don't have to be J.P. Morgan to collect books?" And I got very enthusiastic, and she said, "Well, I stumbled by chance on this antiquarian book fair on my walk." And I said, "Is it open on Sunday?" She says, "Yeah." So that's that next Sunday, we took a stroll down to this small book fair. It was in the basement of one of the Harvard buildings. I don't remember which one. A very large room, not that big, and the dealers were on principally on, showing their wares on card tables. And she brought me over to this dealer named Peter Stern, where she had found this book. And I introduced myself, and Peter introduced himself, and I was looking at the wares on his table, and there was this large gentleman next door, standing next to him, who introduced himself, and it was Dan Poznanski. And we chatted, and he took me out for a cup of coffee and imparted a few words of wisdom. And that was my first meeting with Dan. It was a chat over at a book fair over Peter Stern's table and a cup of coffee.
And then what happened?
Well, by chance, I bumped into him, bumped into Dan on the edge of campus at Harvard Square. I don't recall where. He, questioned me a little bit about to find out how serious I was about Sherlock. Told me about this group he had started, the Friends of Irene Adler, that met at Harvard just before Christmas, and asked me if I'd be interested. And of course, I said yes. We parted ways. And then we met yet again by chance on the campus, at which point I had collection. I don't remember what was in it, but it was about 4 feet of shelf space. And I was very pleased with myself. And I said, Dan, why don't you come back to my place? I want to show you my books. And he came back and he was very polite, nodded, and very encouraging. Said, I don't have a lot of time. I'll see you next weekend. I'd like to come by. Can I come by next weekend? And that was the weekend. The next weekend is the weekend he showed up with these cartons and cartons of books, and went through them in great detail, explaining to me why they were important, what was important in collecting, I needed to find out what was of great interest to me, and these were the important items. That's when he told me about the Bell item, for example. He told me about the BSI publications. And sometime after that, I was at the Friend of Irene Adler's dinner, and then things blossomed after that.
And that's, of course, when he first started calling you.
No, he didn't start calling me Glennie until a few years later.
Oh, okay.
Or a year later. Then I was Glennie. I don't remember when I became Glennie.
That's
the only people who call me Glennie is this guy, Scott Monty. I had two great aunts, English, who called me Glennie, and Dan Poznanski. Nobody else called me Glennie.
That's amazing. Uncle Dan.
Yeah. Well, I had one branch of my family, my ancestors, did a touch and go for a generation in Birmingham. Everybody comes from White Russia, from Belarus, and all my great grandparents.
Hmm.
And through various paths, they made it to New York. But one leg of the family, as I said, did a touch and go for a generation in Birmingham. So I have some British-born relatives.
Well, it's a lovely set of stories that you've told us around this really remarkable collection, around this really remarkable man. I think it's wonderful that the public gets just a glimpse at some of the amazing things here, and has a chance to own them themselves on December 19th. We've got a link in the show notes to the Profiles in Courage auction site and Profiles in History. And of course, if you're interested, you can actually purchase a catalog. That alone is a collector's item, I would think, at this point. It's almost 100 pages long and just filled with these glorious color photos of the collection.
Marsha Malinowski, who did the cataloging, I think did quite a good job. Quite a good job.
Yeah, it's a work of art. It really is. Now, as we're closing here, Glenn, are there any particular items in the collection that you have your eye on?
Yes. But
and how much are you going to pay for them, Glenn? That's what we all want to know.
I'm going to pay the amount I pay will reflect how much I love the items. And the best way to find out is to participate in the auction.
Oh, I like that.
There you go. I like that. Well, thank you for taking the time with us, Glenn, to give us the backstory on how this came to be, and what other collectors should keep in mind as they build their own their own collections themselves.
Yes, the most important thing in my view is to get as smart as you can, as fast as you can. Nothing like being knowledgeable about the books, about where to find books, about who the helpful collectors are. Nothing is more important, my opinion.
And clearly you've illustrated that, in that case, it does depend on the company you keep. You know, surround yourself with other smart collectors and, learn by osmosis as well as by just rote learning.
Well, it's not only the best way, it's the most fun way.
Good to talk to Glenn and get his perspective, and what a grand friendship that he's had with Dan over the years.
It really has. You know, and to hear the two of those guys and to know and experience each of their collections, as I personally have, but even for those folks who are following along either on the show here or who have seen some of their stuff online or potentially who have seen them speak, heard them speak, that is in a realm, in a stratus that few of us can imagine with regard to Sherlock Holmes. It just boggles the mind.
The nice thing, too, is that Glenn has kept that same tradition of sharing one's enthusiasm, sharing one's collection, communicating the joy, giving you the backstory. He's kept that same quality of his... He's kept that same approach to collecting and sharing that Dan has personified alive. I remember the great talk Glenn gave at Chautauqua about his other interest, which was in the Weipra Times. You know, if you remember, Glenn has made a specialty of collecting and finding and discovering the backstory to the degree that he can about all of the World War I related pastiches that folks in the army, the soldiers of World War I, printed up in newsletters, sometimes even in the trenches to amuse themselves. And that's another, you know, it seems like there are just endless different areas of collection and interest and discovery to make about Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, there really are. And I believe that particular area of interest, the trench warfare publications, is actually scheduled for publication in January as part of the BSI series.
Yes, Trenches. Trenches will be out.
Yeah. So stay on the lookout for that.
When you consider the totality of Dan Poznanski's collection, and this is just the portion that's up for auction, mind you, it's astounding. But when you consider the scholarship that has been and continues to be published in the Baker Street Journal since its founding in 1946, it's even more astounding. For more than 70 years, the BSJ has been printing great thoughts from minds the world over, and it doesn't show signs of slowing. In the most recent issue, there's a look at the first sentences in the Sherlock Holmes stories and how they grab the reader's attention. There's one on the dating of the creeping man, a Sherlock Holmes in shorthand, and a harsh look at what was going on in a case of identity, and, of course, much, much more. It's the time of the year when we should consider our subscription to the BSJ, whether it's to renew it or to subscribe for the very first time. The Christmas annual will be here before you know it, and the only way to get it is to have a subscription to the BSJ. Visit BakerStreetJournal.com and be sure that you're prepared for 2018 today.
And as always, you know, it's nice to have our occasional sponsor pop in here from time to time to hear exactly what we can expect from, well, another world.
friends. You don't want government bureaucrats telling you how to take care of your health. That's why you need the new line of Dr. Doyle's Notions and Nostrums from Sherlock Holmes brand products. These reliable 19th century treatments meet 21st century needs. Cure your cold with Whitney's Opium Vapor Oil. Banish dandruff with brilliant cocaine hair dressing. And strengthen your organs with the Vital Power Vacuum Massager. They're the only 19th century remedies that deliver the three C's. Chronically crooked cures.
Cures.
Act now to receive a 10% discount on our new home hair transplant. Remember our motto. Of course it's safe. When you visit your local Sherlock Holmes brand retailer today.
Yes, we're keeping the spirits alive.
I believe I'm in need of a few spirits myself. Well, you know, how do you do a gas lamp for a collection? It's something that perplexed us. But then we took a look into this very rich catalog, and we looked at not only Glenn's introduction, but of another essay contributed by Tom Francis. So we thought, well, why don't we have Tom back to share his essay with us himself?
I've known Dan Spisnansky for more than 40 years. His friendship has meant more to me than even his charm, generosity, enthusiasm, and knowledge of Sherlock Holmes, all of which are prodigious. His collection of all things Sherlockian is amazing. A visit to his home was like going to a holy shrine. There was the stunning array of his collection of pirated editions, the shelves laden with clamshell cases, each containing a rare first edition, or even better, a unique edition of books one had only ever heard about. Now you're able to actually hold and read these rare gems and relics. My favorite memories regarding Dan's collections are the lectures he did for the Friends of Irene Adler. This is a Sherlockian group that Dan founded, which he made open to everyone. He formed this group at a time when most home societies were restricted to men only. What Dan brought to the Friends were things from his collection that were unique, that is, one of a kind. I remember things like Frederick Dorr Steele's inscribed menu from the 1936, the occasion being the second BSI dinner, the signed and inscribed proof copy of one of my favorite books, Vincent Starrett's The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, and material from Conan Doyle's Tours of the United States. These were typical examples of what he would generously allow the attendees to see and even handle. When I say he has unique things, it is like this. I found a piece of rare Sherlock Holmes sheet music, so I asked Dan if he had a copy. His answer was,
I have the contract between the composer and the publisher.
Dan knew how and what to collect. He is unique.
That was great. It's great to hear Tom's perspective.
Yeah.
And isn't it great that Dan has such a cadre, such a community of close friendships? And that's such an important part of the whole enthusiasm for Sherlock Holmes, having this kind of community, this kind of ongoing contact of people all across the country over the years in different ways. And it's really very special.
It is. It is. And it's no coincidence that it's tied to Dan's generosity, you know, just as Glenn described it. So, and speaking of generosity, folks, have you been to our Patreon site? Have you contributed to us via PayPal? Those are a couple of options if you want to show your appreciation for what we here at I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere do. Thank you very much to folks that have come in with some recent Patreon pledges. We very much appreciate your generosity and your willingness to support what other people are supporting as well. Both Chase Abels and Tony Shar are recent contributors via Patreon. So thank you very much. Just head to ihearofsherlock.com, hit that orange button, and let the magic happen. Or just go to patreon.com/ihearofsherlock and work from that angle as well.
Yes, and it's particularly the right time to do that, friends, because what we've been talking to you about, after all, is about collecting. And now all we're asking you to do is follow that same spirit of Glenn Maranker and Tom Francis and Dan Pitsnansky and share a little of your collection of money with us so that we can continue to bring you all this information.
There you go. And until the next time that we bring you information, I am steadfastly going to remain as Scott Monty.
And I am completely committed, or should be completely committed, actually, to be Bert Wolder.
the game's afoot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.